Welcome to the Round 6 Podcast, a weekly roundtable discussion featuring a variety of automotive subjects, interviews, special guests, and stories. Hosted by the Round 6 Gearheads, Brian Stubsky, Brad King, Eric Hibbs, Alex Welsh, and Del Swanson. With us this week in the studio is very special guest, legendary automotive artist, Tom Fritz. Welcome to the Round 6 Podcast. I'm Brian.
I'm Brad.
I'm Alex.
I'm Eric.
And I'm Del.
And with us tonight is a very special guest. In fact, is referred to in the latest issue of Painter's Digest as the Ethel Merman of hot rod art. I'm not sure that's a real thing. We have the spectacularly talented, tremendously attractive, and always fresh-breathed Mr. Tom Fritz.
And if he's wearing his Hawaiian shirt, it's complete. It's a complete, perfect podcast.
No, it's yellow t-shirt today, guys.
Oh man.
We can Photoshop that. That's not a big deal. Nobody told you it's Hawaiian shirt night. Yes, it's. Unfortunately, you missed bright orange turtleneck night, which is usually our Tuesday night thing.
The hottest day of the year, too.
Of course.
Oh, man.
Pit stains optional.
This time of year.
No, it's kind of mandatory. Yeah. So having an absolutely a world-class artist in our midst here, it's a pleasure to have you, sir. I appreciate you making time for us.
Thank you. I think it's really started off like a blast, man. I'm sitting here in the studio. Glad I put the paints down.
Yeah. We should have done it like that. We're sitting here live in Tom Fritz's studio.
Right.
Yeah.
We can edit in all kinds of like crashing sounds in the background, hands being swatted away.
We're all having fun and he's working. That's just the way it is.
Oh, we could do it like a golf episode. It's like, we're looking over Tom's shoulder as he paints.
Yeah. It's like about a five brush.
Totally.
Five brush.
Totally fanboy the thing. Yeah. Remember that time you painted a headlamp? That was awesome. So... What is new in Tom Fritz's world, sir? Is there anything you're working on that you can talk about?
Well, yeah. Right now I'm severely behind my summer show schedule. You know, the amount of work I need to put out for the shows. I'm really behind. I had a really good winter season. And then unfortunately this artist doesn't just sit here and paint all day. I've got other things I need to do, like bring my old website that was era 1998 or so up to snuff. I had so many people at the shows coming up and saying, Tom, I can't even look at your website anymore because I'm on a cell phone or I'm on a iPad or something. And that's the only way you could see my website is, you know, on a computer. So I had to get the new website up. And it's one of those issues that I just dreaded. The old website, I was involved in the code and all the old technology. And it's just advanced to a point where I can't do it anymore by myself. So, you know, I had to get it done. And what you realize, the first thing you go to put a website together like mine, is how prolific you are, mm-hmm. and how many images you've cranked out over the years. And what's up on my site right now is nowhere near close to having everything up on it. I've got to scan a bunch of old transparencies and digitize them and then get them loaded into the website too. So it's just kind of an ongoing process. The new website is up. That's the big news. And now it's time to sit down and lock in and get the paintings completed before the shows.
Nice. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of,
and that's kind of, your website, is your website like, are you selling prints on there? Is there a store, or is it just showing off what you do? What actually is the website?
It's everything now. It's I'm selling prints. I'm selling originals.
Okay.
Posters. In the future, I'll be selling other products. You know, it's an ongoing process right now, but it's all up. The store is working. I can take money, which is a good thing.
Money's a good thing.
That's always a good thing.
You know, but it's just a huge project, and I'm just so glad it's up now.
See, it's a great looking site too. I spent some time on it today. I kind of poked around.
Yeah,
for quite a while.
I checked it out. It was really cool. I saw a lot of prints I'd never seen before. I thought I'd seen most of your stuff at some of the shows. I'd seen some of things that I remember, but I saw a lot of things I'd never seen before, and I thought it was really cool.
Well, we need to tell the listeners the website address, because you know everybody's wondering. It's fritzart.com.
Yes.
So it's a good, clean interface. I like it actually a lot.
Yeah.
I'm actually going through rebuilding my business website right now. And, man, I'll tell you, it doesn't matter how good of a job the designers do for me. The content's up to me, and that's killing me. I don't have time to do it all.
Well, that's part of the issue for me, too, is, you know, I've got a painting schedule that I've got to stick to. And at the same time, you know, you're bound to getting this website done. You've got a production schedule and deadlines and stuff. And I just hate the thought of having something just drag along forever.
Right.
And so that's what it came down to, is just, you know, lock in and do it. Dang it.
And that's the hardest part too. You have to be your own. You have to create your own work first of all, which is tough. Then you have to play salesman and PR and everything else. And I give you a lot of credit. I mean, over the years, you've done such a bang up job of that. I mean, your work speaks for itself. But your ability to have your work everywhere, it seems, you're just, no matter where you turn, you can always find some piece of your work. That's just unbelievable, and it's truly inspiring. I mean,
my office wall, for example.
There's, you know, it's getting to the point now where I have some help in the background that you can't see. And there are people out there that know me well enough, and they know when, I mean, they can tell when things happen that aren't under my hand. You know, all the art I do is myself, but that marketing and the website and messages and stuff. I mean, Twitter and Instagram and all that other stuff, I don't know about that. Someday I'll, I'm sure, but, you know, it's slowly coming into focus for me, but it's difficult. It's, you know, there's this whole business running behind me. And at the same time, you've got to produce, you know, the foundation of that business.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
A lot of problems come up when I'm working in one hemisphere of the brain, and suddenly you got to switch those hemispheres. And that's right. You know, the fog of battle, or whatever you want to call it.
And then someone offers him gum. Yeah.
Yep.
Of course.
Some, you know, people will call me and they got the phone into the bat cave here, and I pick it up and I'm functionally brain dead in that hemisphere when I start the conversation, and sometimes it takes a few minutes to get up to speed. But yeah, you know, that's life for me.
Boy, do I understand.
Yeah, I didn't want to go into the whole, you know, tell us about an average day in the life of Tom. But that, I mean, that really sums it up as, oh my gosh, it just doesn't. You know, a lot of people don't understand that right brain, left brain shift, and that's so tough to deal with.
There's really no average day. It's not like having a 40-hour a week job. You don't wake up every day at the same time, and you know, you make the commute, you come into your office, turn on the lights, and bam, you're an artist suddenly for 8 hours. That's not how it is. you know, sometimes you wake up at 3 a.m. and you're ready to go. And there's, you woke up because your brain is already functioning in that art mode. And the only way to cure it is to go down and work it out. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the painting is driving it. There's a point in my paintings where almost the entire canvas is wet and receptive to the next brush stroke. And, you know, you're just in this groove and the painting is in that same groove with you. And it's just, it's magical and it's working. And for crying out loud, you're not going to drop the brush to go eat dinner.
Right. Or, yeah.
You know, do the laundry, whatever else you have to do. It's, you're hanging on to it and you'll ride it out till the end. Mm-hmm. So
that's, yeah, awesome.
I love it. You know, it's always an, every day is a new adventure. Some days you wake up, you come down, you're ready to do, go to work, and one phone call later, your whole day has shifted. You know, it's off going somewhere else. So
yeah.
Is there a point, is there a point in the painting where you hit the wall, where it's hard to move on?
No.
Ever? No.
No. It's,
you don't get that?
The painting is, there is a challenge in each piece. Let me start over. When I begin a painting, I envision what I want to see. I envision, you know, what I want to say, where I want to take the piece, the color theories, the composition. And as you're working on the painting, as I'm working on the painting, there are these challenges that come up, whether it be lighting or value or compositional situations. And you have to address them and make the entire painting work all at the same time. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, herding cats is another example. just, you know, it's this constant push-pull, trying to keep the composition together. Mm-hmm. And taking it to a completion, and knowing when to stop. And it's just, it gets easier as the years go by, but sometimes one will reach up and grab you and take you for a ride that you never thought you'd be on. Okay. It's so much different than a job where you're, you know, screwing part A into tab B.
Right.
Day long. And exactly. Yeah, I mean, I absolutely love what I do.
It shows. Cool.
It definitely shows. And one of the things, Not to jump too far ahead, I was going to try to keep this on some kind of, you know, logical train, but one of the things about your paintings, I had read at one point, it might have been even in your biography on your website, it talks about how your paintings are kind of a recollection, almost like a collection of memories, like you're looking at a memory. It has that, just that slightly soft touch to it, you know, where time has kind of gone by and the lighting is just, you know, a little more vivid. And things like
almost
that.
Like it's a good movie.
Exactly. You really nail
emotion.
That. And I think my question there was, what inspired you to kind of approach lighting the way that you do? Was there something at some point that inspired you that way? Was there a certain artist? Or is it just kind of your natural way of looking at it?
It kind of developed when I was in school. I took 5 years at Cal State Northridge, wound up with a bachelor's degree, and I had a series of teachers, professors in the art school that what was really neat about it was that this was the mid-70s. The school was geared towards abstract expressionism at that time. In the fine arts, there were some illustration classes, you know, the graphics classes, that sort of thing. But the painting was geared more towards the abstract. And as a student, I knew that I wanted to get out of school and make a living doing this. And so I was more representational, and, you know, I wanted the illustration background. And at the time, one of the competitors in my life was Art Center, which was down the road. Mm-hmm. However, the situation was, I was living in my garage in North Hollywood, and a full-time student, and a 30-hour-a-week job that I had. I was tapped out. I was maxed out time-wise, and I could not swing the tuition at the time to go to Art Center. So, you know, you take what you get and make the best out of it. So I went to I was in the abstract school, taking the classes, the paintings and everything. And I was having issues with everything that I was doing in these classes was not representational. The product was, you know, they were abstractions and, you know, composition, the painting, everything was abstract, and I was having a real hard time grasping that concept. When I got out of school, I took my portfolio around, and luckily I had done enough drawing and representational, you know, figure drawing and a little bit of technical drawing, and I was able to show that I did have that kind of a background. And so I started picking up some jobs, freelance type stuff. In the late 70s, there was a recession, and it hit pretty hard. Where I was geared towards was the Saturday morning cartoon industry in the San Fernando Valley, especially.
Really?
Yeah, that's where I wanted to, you know, that was a living, to be a layout artist, do the background illustrations, you know, the architectural room interiors, buildings, exteriors, that sort of thing. They had all the studios were out there, Filmation, Hanna-Barbera, Ruby Spears, of course, Disney, and the list goes on. That was where the industry was. And at some point, the union went on strike because all of the work was being shipped to Japan because the work was getting done for, you know, less money. And the situation came up for me to do a little bit of work scabbing for the studios. And that's how I built my portfolio. And when the strike was over and everybody went back to work, there I was with my portfolio, and everybody asked me, how did I get that in my portfolio? And of course, you know, there I was. And no one would take me. So now what do you do? Well, I got a job finally at ITT Gilfillan, which was a radar manufacturer. See, the whole San Fernando Valley was a huge aerospace manufacturing facility at the time. And my father worked for the Skunk Works at Lockheed. And so anyways, I got this job as a technical illustrator, starting out with a whole set of the rapidograph pens. I'm drawing battery lugs and screws and nuts on Mylar. And I mean, it paid the bills, but it was the most incredibly boring.
For some, it's soul crushing. I mean, that's tough to do.
When I went in for my interview, the, my boss came in and gave me what do they call an orthographic projection of a part. You know, top view, side view, front view, that kind of thing. He goes, can you draw this part for me in, I think it was orthographic projection, which is a 60, 90, 30 degree viewpoint of this part, where you can actually take measurements off of your drawing and build this part. So I did. It took me like 2 seconds after reading the blueprint, and I gave it back to him. He goes, "Oh my gosh," he goes, "this is in perspective too."
Well, duh, I'm an artist.
So I was hired on the spot, and there began my career. Now, when I started there, a lot of the old men that were working in the bullpen with me were actually old animators from the studios. Now, the studios at that time, the strike was just over, but Disney was in its death throes. Animation, traditional animation was it was dying, almost dead, until Ralph Bakshi brought out the Wizards and the 5-0 Mouskowitz. Remember the little mouse?
Right.
Yeah. Those are kind of what saved, actually got breathed air back into the industry. But these old guys were they had been fed up with all the baloney that they were getting out of the studios. And those were the guys that I was working with. And I hooked myself up to them, and I just sat there and bled them dry. I mean, I had guys that were background artists, painters. There was a gentleman from the design studio up in Detroit. Was it Center of Creative Services? He was working there. I had a gentleman that was worked for Disney on several of their productions. I learned a whole bunch of neat stuff from them, and my career just went off from there. But how I got into what I'm doing now. Wait a second. Is this a question that you guys asked me?
Yes.
This is incredible. I don't want to stop you.
Please continue.
I'm sorry. If I didn't want to hijack your.
No.
No, this is all about you.
This is good. You're making our job so easy.
Okay.
Well, I think Brian just fired me. So
I'm just right now. I am fascinated. I'm in my happy place. You can get a raise, Eric. This is good.
Sweet.
Well, I just want, once I start lying, I can't shut up. So, so let's see, where was, when you're working in a company and you're looking at all the other guys that are on their drawing boards, and it was great because I was surrounded by actual working artists, and each one of them had their own story, and it was just a wonderful time in my life because I wasn't listening to professors tell their story. I was listening to actual artists that, were doing this day in and day out and hammering through it just like I was, but they each had their own styles and processes and vision, and I just sat there and just soaked it up. But during the day, what happens is you are given these projects, and I loved getting the projects to work on, but what killed the whole industry for me was the middle management politics. That day in, day out agony and strife of these people that are fighting for that corner office with the window. And they're doing it on the backs of the artists who are just there to do the best they can with what they're doing. And the little power plays. I remember at one point in my career, I had three managers. I was working for three managers, and none of them knew what the other manager was having me do. And it was kind of like having those three crows, Heckle and Jekyll, fence behind you as you're working. What are you working on? This project. Well, how come you're not working on my project? And it's like, I can only do one thing at a time. That sort of thing. And it was just killing it. And I would go home at night sometimes really frustrated. And in order to make extra money and to support the house and the family that was coming along, I was freelancing all the time. I was doing work for Kaiser Permanente, which is a huge medical entity out here in Southern California. I had other clients, a lot of clients down in Hollywood. I was doing a lot of cartooning at the time also. And it was a lot of, you know, those projects were fun and they all had their realistic deadlines. And a lot of those deadlines were time crunches. Consider that at the time when you were working back then, we didn't have computers sitting on our desks, so we weren't able to do all of our own typesetting and, you know, all of the Photoshop that you want to do and everything to get your project done. If you needed typography, you needed typesetting, you had to order that out, and a service bureau had to drive it, messenger it out to your studio at night. If you needed photostats, if you needed, you know, supplies, all of that was, you had to plan that into your timeline and to meet the deadlines. This is on top of a 40-hour-a-week job.
Yeah.
And it was just getting frustrating. And at one point, Molly, my wife, she came into the studio one night and she goes, "You look terrible. What, you know, what's up?" I looked at her and said, "You know, the next person that comes into the studio, they can have a suitcase with $1 million in it and slap it up on my drawing board and tell me to draw a stick figure and I'll tell them to go to hell. I've just had it. Don't, you know, I don't care." And so Molly said, "Well, what do you want to do?" And I said, "I just want to do my own paintings. I don't want to do my own work." And this is when you got, you know, you married your best friend. She looked at me, she says, "Well, then let's do it." And I was like, you know, I was, wow. You know, I couldn't ask for more. And
does
from
Molly
that,
have a sister? I asked her a friend.
Yeah. No. So from that day forward, it was, you know, it was, I just wanted to do this for myself. And it has been a hell of a journey. It's been a long road, sometimes a grind, but, you know, I'll never look back, you know. It got me out of that daily, day in, day out commute, you know, dealing with the management, that sort of thing. I left that all behind and never looked back.
That's awesome.
Outstanding.
I think everybody wishes they could do that, but nobody, you know, people like me just don't have the talent to do so.
Sometimes you have to be forced to do it.
Yeah.
You know, and that's kind of what it was for me. I don't know if I've got talent or just, you know, I just keep, you know, smacking myself up against a wall every time and just keep, you know.
Let me assure you, you do have talent, a whole hell of a lot of it.
But it's, you know, I don't know. It's just been hard work. It's, I don't know if it's, I don't know. Talent is something, I don't know if it's, I don't think I was born with it, because I don't know if people are born with talent. I think it has to be developed, and that was the secret, was it's a constant development. I know I paint differently today than I did 30 years ago.
Right.
You know, and it's just it's scrubbing down those brushes, putting the miles on them, and constantly developing how you lay a paint down. You know, getting those processes down and constantly keeping your eyes open for what you've seen in your life, what you want to report back to people, and coming up with the solution that I guess hopefully does it adequately for people.
You know, it's interesting to hear you say that you're still working on techniques and such, because, you know, I think of you as the absolute, well, just not me, but your premier fine artist in the automotive world.
Oh, gosh.
But to hear that, you know, you continually work on those techniques and stuff is refreshing. That's neat. I like to hear things like that. That's cool.
Well, thank you. There's keeping my eyes open and seeing what I want to do. You know, how do you interpret something that happens around motorcycles, aircraft, automobiles, you know, spoked wheels spinning.
Right.
How do you, we've all seen photographs of it, and there's the cartoonist's convention for the spinning propeller, how you render a spinning propeller or spinning spokes. But the thing is I'm working in paint, which is essentially butter. And how do you, without replicating a photograph, how do you interpret spinning spokes with that butter and make it appear or make the impression of those spinning spokes? And that's where the challenge comes in. I don't want to replicate photograph in that impression, but to do it with just rough brushwork. And how you apply the paint, that's the problem. Your solution is in there somewhere. And I'm learning stuff even as I go now on how to get that sense of motion.
Wow. See, and I think you've got it nailed tenfold.
Oh, gosh. Thanks.
You know, it's one of the things that I love about just studying your work is that you capture something photographs can't. I mean, not don't, but can't. And I said it earlier, there's emotion in every brush stroke, and it shows, and it's amazing. And, you know, photographs will never capture that. So... it's yeah.
Part of
I love looking at your work. I've been a fan of it for more years than I can remember.
Thank you. Part of now here's this may get really thick if I go way off and you got to pull me back in, I'll listen to you and come back. Remember, I told you that I was learning all that abstraction,
right?
And composition, and you know, I work basically in shapes and color, and how to activate a canvas just with shape and color,
right?
Masses. I still work that way. This is where about 25 years ago, I suddenly had this epiphany, and it all came together for me. Everything that I studied in school that I was resisting, it was inside of me. It had been placed inside of me, and I was drawing on it every day. And once I realized that, I went back and I just, you know, I went back to that that tool in my box and pulled it out and embraced it and never went elsewhere. Really? So I'm working, when you say my stuff doesn't look like a photograph, thank you, I don't want it to be photographic. There's something about a photograph, there's a consistency of vision in a photograph.
Right.
When you look at it, when you hold a photograph in your hand, that's not how we see the world. When we see the world, when you look at the world outside of a photograph, you focus on various things, points of interest you focus on. Everything else is peripheral, and that's how it should work in a painting. You know, I don't want to have just a reproduction of a photograph. I want to make visible that experience of seeing in life. So I can blur edges, I can soften edges, I can make edges hard and focused, and I can lead the eye around. And that's, to me, that's what makes a painting interesting, is leading the eye. And I can do it very easily with paint. I can do it with charcoal. Drawings in charcoal in a painterly fashion, that works for me. It satisfies my eye. But I hope I'm making sense out of this.
100%.
Yeah, because it's, you know, a lot of people will look at my work and say, well, you know, you don't have every nut in the you know, or on the panel there, or stuff is missing, and there's a reason there's stuff missing. I don't want you to concentrate on it. I could throw it in there, believe me. I worked in gouache commercially for one of the Fortune 50 aerospace firms. In fact, when I finally quit the defense aerospace arena, I was staff artist for Northrop Grumman.
Really?
There you go, Alex.
Yeah, that's my company. I still work for them. 28 years.
Okay. And there were some, I mean, I love the job. This is the, here's another thing. Working in defense as a male that grew up in the San Fernando Valley, late 50s through the 60s and 70s. I mean, that was so cool. My dad was Lockheed. He worked on the SR-71, the U-2.
Wow.
And later on, I found out because he held his secrets till the day he died so well, but I found out that he was involved on the stealth fighter.
Right on.
Really?
The reason was, at one point, before we knew what the stealth bomber, the B-2 and the F-117 were, one of the projects I was working on for Northrop needed an illustration of a stealth fighter. And I didn't know, you know, the artists that I knew in the industry thought that the stealth fighter would look very similar to the SR-71 because that was the stealthiest plane that we had at the time.
That's right.
And that is kind of what my illustration looked like. And my pop came over one day to the studio and he saw this thing on the drawing board and he stood there looking at it. And
this is so cool.
He looks at it and he goes, "What's that?" And I said, "That's a stealth fighter." And he looked at it for the longest time and he didn't say anything. And I said, "Well," and he just looked at it. He never said anything. He just looked at me and said, raised his eyebrows and walked off. I mean, that's a man that can keep his secret, right?
No.
But
he got to work with some cool mavericks of aerospace back then. You know, Ben Rich was the 117 guy, and Kelly Johnson was the guy that basically started Skunk Works. I mean, he got to work with those guys. That was a cool time in aerospace.
Those were names that were at the dinner table at night. Ben Rich, Kelly Johnson. You know, my dad was talking to Mom about how his day went, and those were the names that were out.
Yeah, those guys were legends, man. Still are.
There was a time my father, when I was 7 years old, he had a Honda 90, one of the old Trail 90s. 64 and a half was the first year of them, and he had 64 and a half Trail 90. 7 years old, he threw me on the back of that, or actually we put the truck in the back of the 62 Ford Falcon pickup early one morning, 4 o'clock in the morning. We drove to a man's house and we picked up his Honda 90 and we threw it in the back of the truck. And my father and this gentleman and myself drove out to the Death Valley area and we went on a motorcycle ride for the day and returned home that night. This was in 1964 or so. And I knew this gentleman by his name. His first name was Glenn.
Oh, wow.
And just in the past half a year, after my father passed, we found a bunch of photographs that he had taken, slides that he had taken, and there was a few of these slides that he had taken of this ride that I was on with him. And there was this gentleman. With the power of the internet, I did a search on this man that went with us on that ride. He was the first passenger in an airplane. He was a test engineer for Lockheed, but he was the first passenger to go supersonic in an aircraft.
Whoa.
And that's just like, wow, these are the guys that, you know, this was from when I was a kid. So now I'm working for in defense 40 years later, and I was working on a project for Northrop. I guess I can talk about it now. It's out there. It was the THAAD missile system, which right now is being deployed. You hear about it in the news. It's being deployed in Japan and up in the Korea area. And this is the missile system that is used to take out missiles that are incoming. It doesn't explode in the vicinity of the incoming missile. It's like a bullet hitting a bullet right on.
Yeah.
It destroys the incoming with kinetic energy.
Wow.
I was working on that, you know, back in the 90s. And this was when computers were not as powerful as they are now. And it was a totally black operation. It was just like the coolest thing. You know, I did a lot of artwork for it because at the time, a lot of engineers didn't know what the word network was. And I had to know what network was so I could illustrate it and do these paintings. I was doing these large paintings that were like you'd see them in a National Geographic, you know, describing how this missile system worked.
Wow.
The artwork was being shipped around to all the other companies. Lockheed was another player in that. I worked on a program for the Army. And you see the soldiers, how they're dressed today. I was involved in how the way the soldiers dress. I was doing these drawings kind of from skin out on how the uniforms were placed on a soldier.
No kidding.
The technology that was going into these things. It was it was like being a big kid, because as a kid, you know, I drew, you know, on your desk, you'd draw tanks and planes and ships and, you know, the stuff you get in trouble for at school, you know,
as a kid, huh?
As a kid, you know,
I'm still doing that.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, you know, some of us move on, but I mean, it was just the coolest thing, you know. But so when I was a kid, growing up in the San Fernando Valley, my father was born and raised in Southern California. He had a 41 Ford when he went to USC. And he had it slightly hot-rodded, customized at the time. And I have a few pictures of him standing next to that car. And when I was a very small child, we had a 50 Ford Woody wagon and a 56 Chevy two-door sedan. Later, a 63 Bel Air wagon. I mean, those are all cool cars. And my dad always was working on them in the garage. I remember him picking me up and holding me in his arms, looking into the engine bay of the 56. He had the 235 six-cylinder in it. He had the valve covers off, and the engine was running. And he'd lean over and blip the throttle so I could watch the valve train blur.
Mm-hmm.
And stuff like that. I mean, he was always out there. I remember the burn of cleaning solvent on my hands because I always helped him wash the parts and rebuilding the carburetors. And, you know, on the motorcycles, he was always working on those and taking me for rides on. You know, that was just the thing that we did. When I was 12, 13 in that range, there was this plastic model at the store that was the invisible V8 engine.
Oh man, yes.
Nice. Just a quick head count. Who here has built that?
Oh, yes. I'm raising my hand.
But I'm just the biggest slob with the glue, and I built the engine.
You made it like more or less the opaque V8.
It was opaque, yes. It wasn't clear.
And it ran really rough, man. It's just, mine ran really rough. And you know what? And my dad saw that and he goes, you know what? He goes, this is nothing. He goes, come with me. He threw me on the back of the motorcycle one day, drove me out to one of his buddy's houses, walked me out around the side of the garage, and there was this engine block. It was a 283 Chevy. Greasy as hell. He goes, you want that? I said, yeah. And so we came back out with the truck and threw this thing in the back, took it home, and he dumped it on the garage floor. He goes, "This is yours." He goes, "The first thing you're going to do is tear it apart. So now I get to use the tools. It was all mine. I got to learn about you can't come in the house until all the grease is off of you."
that was mom's rule, right?
Yeah, exactly. And but I tore the engine apart, and of course I already knew how things worked because of the model kit. But this was real, and all of my buddies found out that I had a real engine, and suddenly they're over there. Like, it was cool, and I was, you know. That was just the coolest thing to have this going on out there. Well, I cleaned it up, and Dad said, "Well, what do you want to do now?" I said, "I want to put it back together." He says, "Well, there's a way that you have to do that." So this is where the challenge came. I started having to mow lawns, wash windows. I had a newspaper route. I had three newspaper routes. You had to pay for this stuff. First thing, get that block hot tanked and magnafluxed. Took it down, hot tank, $25, Magnaflux, I think it was $10 or something like that. My block was cracked.
Oh, man.
So, you know, and I just kicked out $35 for this. And I was crestfallen. And Dad says, "Well," he goes, "got to get you another block." So back in the truck, out to Marv's, all Chevy only, fighting the junkyard dogs on a Saturday morning, got out. Pulled out another 283. This one was out of a 65 Corvette, I believe, and brought it home. Same thing, hot tank, Magnaflux, the block is okay, and then on we went, you know. At the time, I remember I wanted it to go into an engine stand. And if you remember, you looked in the hot rod magazines in the back, there was always one of those, you know, the engine stand. I don't know, was it $29 or something like that? $39 for engines?
Yeah.
I was a 12-year-old kid, and I couldn't afford that, but I could afford the iron.
There you go.
Dad brought home a bunch of iron and some hacksaw blades, and he helped me. That's where I learned to weld. I welded together this engine stand for this engine block. That engine and the engine stand are still in my garage.
Awesome.
Wow.
That is great.
That's awesome.
So wow. Quite a bit longer than the ones made in China, huh?
Do you have a plan to put that engine in anything, or is this just going to be kind of a, like, your own personal time capsule that you hold on to?
Oh, yeah. No. Here was my plan, and it's still my plan, and of course, life has gotten in the way of it, but it's still my dream. Carcraft magazine back then in that era, early 70s, about maybe 70, 71, Dick Scritchfield published a book on building your T-bucket roadster. And I still have that magazine. It's out, you know, I still have it. I showed it to Jake Jacobs when he was out here, and he was like, he was laughing. But that was my plan. Dad threw me on the back of the old Honda, the 175 Honda. We went out to the Burbank area to Cal Automotive Glass at the time, and I saw that I wanted a 23 the fiberglass 23 T bucket with the pickup, you know, the short pickup bed on it.
Yeah.
And that was my plan. Well, by this time I was 14 years old. I have my engine, it's still built, it's in the stand, and now the thing was to get the iron for the frame and to weld it up in the garage. And you're 14 now, you're in junior high, and I could not get enough money to get the project going. And by the time I was getting closer to getting the money, I was now 15 and I needed some wheels fast. And I had $400 one day, and I went out and I got myself a 56 GMC half-ton pickup, which is beside the house out here under a tarp right now, but I still got it. I rebuilt it as best I could back then. I drove it until I was in my early 20s. I drove it everywhere. And so now I have two projects that I can't get to. And my grandparents lived in Tahunga, which is a part of the San Fernando Valley. And ever since I was growing up, they had a 1954 two-door Delray coupe and Chevy. And when grandfather passed away in the late 90s, my father and his brother went up. They didn't want the car. They put the word out to all of the males in the family, starting from the oldest to the youngest. I'm the youngest. Did anybody want the old 54? And it was all turned down until I raised my hand. And the 54 is now in my garage waiting for its turn. So there's my kind of my background. You know, I'm just I love these old cars. They all have history to me. I rebuilt the truck. I rode in the 54 when I was 7 years old. I mean, these have been in my life. And now you understand that I'm this guy that has this passion for engines and gasoline and oil and fixing and repairing and, you know, the whole thing. But now you have this passion and you're an artist, and all the time you were around these cars, your dad was taking you to Saga Speedway on Saturday nights and taking you to all these automotive motorcycle events. And there was this one character at Saga Speedway. He was an artist, and he had his little table, his little card table set up every Saturday night, and he was doing drawings of the cars, the stock cars that raced at Saga's. And we would walk by, and I would look at that, and I was like, that I would love to be doing that. That, you know, I'm sure I can find out the artist's name, but that was kind of like a little spark plug for me, you know. Here was an artist that was selling his art of the cars, of this thing that we all loved. So it just, you can see how this big ball just keeps building. It's, you know, this passion with these layers on it. It's kind of like how a jawbreaker is made, you know, just another layer on top of it.
Yeah.
And now you're a painter, you're an artist, you've got some skills behind you, you're searching for your sense of imagery. You know, what is it that you're going to focus on? What makes you want to paint a painting? And I had all of these experiences and this passion and this impetus to put something out there on canvas or paper or whatever it is, just make that mark, whatever it might be. And that's where it came from. When I sat down finally to do what I wanted to do, this was the actual starting point, I guess. I was in my garage, and I was redoing the brakes on the old truck. My next-door neighbor comes down the hill. He was an older man. He pulls up a milk crate, and I was working on the front brake drums. And we were talking about brakes. And I mentioned something, I forgot what it was, and he goes, that's been around for a while. I said, really? I said, I didn't know it was around for that long. He goes, oh, no. He says, that's been around for a while. In fact, we used to have that set up when we raced. Now, this was something I didn't know about my neighbor. I said, you raced? I said, where did you race? He goes, out on the dry lakes. And this was in the early 80s. And this predated Don Montgomery's books on the dry lakes races, or it was just about the same time that Don was coming out with that, his books. And I had heard about this from my father. He had taken me out to El Mirage a couple times, and I never made the connection. And suddenly something clicked in my head. I said, you race? He goes, yeah. He goes, just a second, I'll go get my shoebox. So he went back to his garage, came back down, and opened up his shoebox, and in there were all these photographs that were taken, black and white photographs that were taken of the dry lakes by himself and his brother. And they were, the photos back then were kind of traded like baseball cards were. Huh. If you were racing out there, you had to have, you know, your buddy's photos, and, you know, so you collected these things. And I was just dumbstruck. I was like, I was floored. And I knew at that moment that this, I had to capture the emotions that I was seeing. You know, there was this whole, that era, the emotive quality that I was getting from these, it was evocative. I had to put this down. And that's my start of my first paintings of the early days of hot rodding. And it kind of just took off from there, and I never looked back. It was the way that I eventually, that was my ticket to getting out of the day job in defense. For several years, I didn't know. I had 12, maybe 15 of these paintings that were ready to sell. I didn't know how to get rid of them. And how do you sell fine art? I didn't know. No one taught me that in school. I was raised in the commercial art world, working for companies. You know, they throw you a paycheck and own the copyrights to your work, and you never see it again. So how do you sell this stuff? I didn't know. I went to the bookstore. I found a book called The Artist's Market. And that book, they used to sell it. I don't know if it's still in bookstores, or I guess they don't make bookstores anymore. But
sadly,
Amazon will open one next week.
Yeah. But this book had, it was, the way it was organized was every art gallery in all 50 states alphabetically listed, you know, by state in alphabetical order. Well, I didn't know what I was doing, you know, so I made 18 sets of 20 slides of my work, you know, so figure out how many slides you shot and the processing for those slides. 18 sets of these. Each set of slides went into a slide sheet, and Molly would individually typewrite a letter of introduction, and then letter of introduction, you know, what I had. If you didn't want this, if you don't want to talk about this, please send, you know, return the slide set to me in the self-addressed stamp return envelope that I provided. So every one of those that went out, starting with AAA Art Gallery in Anchorage, Alaska. Okay. You get a set of slides, the cover letter, and the return envelope with postage, you know, on it. Well, you know, I'm a Fritz, you know. I wasn't born with all those smarts that my pop had, but it turns out that I had all of the slide sets returned to me with, you know, hey, it looks good, but we're not interested. Why did I start in Alaska and go on to Arizona and go on to, you know, Connecticut?
Arkansas,
yeah. The first bite, I was got down to Michigan and Detroit, and there was a little hot rod shop out there that was having an art show. And they got back with me and said, hey, can you send something for the art show? So I sent them a 3-foot by 4-foot, and it sold that night, and that was the start of it.
Great.
If I had thought of sending something to Motor City at the start, you know, I would have been much.
Well, right there, you just gave away one of the great secrets to somebody who's going to try this out. You know, it's start in the middle and work your way outward. And
exactly.
Not to go off topic from there, though, but you know, while we're giving out great career advice to a young artist looking to go into school now, would you suggest drawing the turtle or the pirate?
I drew both and never got.
Brian got him tattooed, one on each shoulder. So.
Actually, I've got one on each shoulder and each butt cheek. I'm going after each one of the schools that denied me entrance, so it's working out pretty good.
Well, I got a question, Tom. You're talking about these, you know, these art places. You sent, you're in that, you know, the automotive hot rod capital of the world, of the planet, and you're sending stuff to Alaska. What made you leave Southern California to send stuff? I mean, what? Why didn't you just keep it all here? What made you go elsewhere?
Frankly, because I didn't know how to sell it. I thought, hey, you need a studio or a gallery to sell art. And I didn't know any, I didn't know, you know, rule number one. I didn't know, you know, there is no rule book to this. There's no instruction manual. And the thought of hauling it around to an event, anything, you know, hot rod reunion, that hadn't occurred to me. I thought that you went through galleries, and that's my answer. That's why it happened that way.
Okay.
I would go to these events, and I never, that one artist I saw at Sauga Speedway back in the late 60s, that was pretty much it. When you go to events, you don't see artists selling work there. I didn't know where else to start. So, you know, that was my reason. And then once I was kind of absorbed into it, then you start seeing, you know, there's these little shows that you can do, and you can, you know, you can set up your art at a swap meet and sell it next to a stack of old wheels or something if you want. But it basically what it was getting it out there in front of people, and okay. I didn't know how to do it. But and now with the internet, it's so much easier to get your artwork in front of people. I mean, the social media thing. I mean, if that had been invented 30 years before, that would have been so much easier.
Yeah.
I tell you, for a hack like me, it was a godsend. You know, nothing beats being able to toot your own horn and just kind of throw things in front of a captive audience every day.
I had, you know, 20 sets of slides. That's 20 times 20. That's 400 slides. And each time it went out, you know, the postage on a return envelope for those things, double the cost. It was, it was incredible. But I guess that's, you know, paying your dues. And I think that although doing it the way I did it isn't the way to do it anymore, I think that the same difficulties have kind of transferred themselves. It's in a different medium, you know.
Definitely. Yeah. It's kind of hard to choose. You got to choose your platform now and what time of day and what day to post. And
so true.
Yeah. There's things that are beyond my understanding anymore. And certainly my inclination to learn it, you know, I just want to paint more. I don't want to learn Kodo again or, mm-hmm. you know, there's things that I've learned, when the one thing about this computer technology and the constant updating and the, you know, you got to keep on top of it or you get very, very rusty. And I know a lot of the younger guys out there are probably shaking their head at me, but, you know, it's just the way that's my experience here.
No, I agree. I both love and hate computers.
Oh, there's days I could throw this thing in the dumpster.
Yeah.
Like right now.
Hey.
Well, speaking of learning here, you know, I really admire you because if anyone has a question about how you do things or your process, you're always more than willing to tell them how you know how you do things or explain your process, which is the mark of a of a great artist and a person who is comfortable in their own skin and their own abilities. And I have to, you know, I have to give you kudos for that.
Well, thank you. Yeah, there's it's really cool to be at a show and to have the artists come up. Yeah, I can always tell when an artist comes up to me. Usually they go, they put their nose right up to the canvas. You know, it's the civilians walk by and you know they're 4 feet away and going, wow, is that the way you do it? But the artists, you know, wham, they're right up against it.
I think Tom had to warn me that it was still wet.
Oh, at least
don't
he warned
it,
you.
Dale, don't lick it.
Yeah, don't lick it. There's lead paint in there.
Oh, this could explain a lot then. Hang on.
It's kind of fun to, when I get in these discussions about art at a show, I mean, the rest of the universe be damned, because, I mean, if there can be somebody standing over there, hey, I want to buy this, and I'm in that mode, and, you know, you're either going to have to sit there and struggle through me with my insanity, but, you know, I go off in a different plane. I love that. I've had students from Art Center come over, and we're discussing color theory at a show. And they're looking at colors, and I'm breaking it down for them, and asking, what do you see there? What color is that? And they're describing it. And then it's always fun to isolate the color and show them exactly what the color is with nothing surrounding it, no juxtaposition going on. And to see that amazement, you know, a lot of that is intuitive for me, but it's fun for me to kind of, it's kind of like teaching them.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can see them absorbing. They're doing the same thing that we all do, is trying to make sense of what you're looking at and you know, grasp it, and then relate that to someone else.
Even just that small little with the speck of other color in the highlight. And I'll let you explain it, but that was just mind-blowing to me.
Oh, or I'm playing with your rods and cones in your eyes?
Yes, that was, it's incredible.
But all that was just my interpretation of what's going on in your eyeball. Let's see if I can start here. Back in the late 60s, remember blacklight posters?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Okay. I've seen these before. There was a certain blacklight poster, or there were many of them, and they were made up of two colors. One wasn't, it was like a red orange and a kind of a lime green. And these were the fluorescent colors. And what was this particular poster, when you looked at it, your eyeball would vibrate. It was the most irritating thing to look at.
Oh, you've never seen me getting out of the shower then.
Here was the thing. The word, I remembered that eyeball irritation. And when as I'm working with the color in my painting, I started noticing that if you work two contrasting colors, you know, diametrically opposed on the color wheel, of the same value, which is generally the best, the closest you're going to get would be a red and a green. Mm-hmm. A yellow and a violet, there's a difference, you know, they're worlds apart in terms of value.
Mm-hmm.
Blue and orange can get closer. The red and the green are they're almost right there. And I was thinking, when I look at a specular highlight on a vehicle, or if I quickly look at the sun, which I recommend doing, there's something going on when you look at it. I'm not looking at a blast of a big pile of white paint. That's not what I'm seeing. I can look at white paint all day. But when I look at that specular highlight, I can't look at it very long because it's irritating to my eye. When I realized that, how can I irritate my eye with paint? And I started playing with it, and it's not only the zinger color, but it's everything that you put around that zinger. I mean, it's
most of us will have just stabbed ourselves in the eye with a paintbrush.
Well, that was basically what I did, and I still do it. It's fun to do. It's you know, I don't want it to be, you know, the go-to, the you know, sometimes various artists, you look at their work and there's always the one thing that nails it for you. It's like, yep, that's that artist, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I don't want to be that, but I use it sparingly and when it needs to be used. But you know, that's how it works. I've done other things and other paintings. I love the feeling of light coming from within the painting out at you. Mm-hmm. And basically, all I'm working with are tubes of color. You can buy them off of the shelf. You can squeeze them out, and all they do is they reflect light back at you. There's no light coming from within those colors in that tube. But it's how you put them down and what colors you put up against other colors that make that quality come out of the painting. And I always enjoy that. There's other artists out there. I mean, there's colorists out there that do amazing work.
There's lots of artists out there. This is true. But you represent us. You're the hot rod guy. See, so that's you know, and I'm probably speaking for all the guys. You are our artist. You're kind of our guy.
And, absolutely.
So there's other artists over there, there's not a lot of fine art. I mean, you got, you know, Kenny Youngblood does fine art, and there's a few other guys, but you're our guy. That's just all there is to it.
there's a lot of, you know, I mean, it's a big world out there, and there's a lot of stuff to report on. And yes, Kenny is he's an old friend of mine. He was there early on when I was looking for, you know, how to get this thing going. He helped out quite a bit. Steve Stanford is a true gentleman too.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Just, you know, his talent and his vision is just remarkable. And there's others out there. I hate to start getting into a long list of them, because right. What happens is I leave somebody out, and you know, the next thing I know, I'm getting smacked up at a show somewhere.
Right. Yeah, we don't want that to happen.
We got your back.
We'll stab somebody in the eye with a paintbrush. Ball
for you.
No, I know what you mean, though.
Thank you.
So, Tom, I wanted to ask one other question about, you know, kind of your the era that you paint in. Because, you know, growing up through the 60s and 70s, you know, it's when fad tees were everything. Mm-hmm. Your art is, from most of what I've seen, the hot rod art at least, and most of the motorcycle art is all like just post-war. So was that as much just kind of your dad's style of car, or was that just what you were passionate about? Where does that all come into play?
A few things. It's the start, and it was the history of it. When you have to understand something, for an artist, especially for me, I like to paint things that are not handy. They're not there every day. The scallop paint jobs, and you know, I appreciate the cars of the 60s, and I lived through the 70s, you know, the Camaros and the Trans Ams and the side pipes and all that good stuff. And I'll explain how that relates in a short while here. But the early days of hot rodding, to a guy that was born when I was in 57 and through the early 60s, it wasn't really historical at that point. It was old. And so when you picked up the hot rod magazines, you really never saw it. you saw it in your dad's old pictures, maybe. And my dad would sometimes draw an old hot rod. He was an engineer, so he had some basic drawing skills. But I never saw it. And as you get older, 23 T bucket, if you talk to the old guys, those are kind of goofy. Because they were there at the start, and their, what they had was the ultimate cool, and it evolved into this, and then that evolved into this, and that evolved into this. So as an artist, what would I rather paint? A villager from a southern Pacific island who I've never seen before, wearing his fancy dress, or their fancy bridal, the woman in her fancy bridal outfits, or would I rather paint my next door neighbor that comes out and mows the lawn every weekend without a shirt? You know, right. It's you want to paint something that's exotic, that's
you haven't seen my neighbor without his shirt.
No doubt,
but. So this is where it comes from. Now, and I love the history of it. I study it. I got all the magazines. But now there's something else that comes out. As a kid developing, when I would go to the races, I was kind of the goofball. I was the nerd. I was the dork, the spaz, you know.
And I'll bet you didn't see that coming. Be sure to join us for part two of this dynamic episode with automotive artist Tom Fritz when the Round 6 podcast picks up next week. Thanks again for listening. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please head over to iTunes and feel free to subscribe, rate, and review our podcast if you would. Also, be sure to keep in touch with us on our website at www.round6pod.com.